Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair with Lynn Curtis of the club's Member-Led Arts Forum and your organizer for this program. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now I'm just delighted and honored to introduce Peter Sellers, the renowned director and master theater artist, and also Matthew Shilvuk, San Francisco Opera's general director. Is this your first time? It's his first time at the Commonwealth Club, so we'll hope to have you back as much as possible. He's devoted his career to executive management in the performing arts, born in Kidderminster, England, and he studied performance and history, reading music at Christ Church, Oxford University. Also holds a master's degree in public administration, because somebody's got to manage things, from the University of Massachusetts. From the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He worked with the New Chamber Opera in Oxford, England, and Port Opera in Portland, Maine. Was a fellow with Opera America, the national service organizations for opera companies in North America, and went around to various organizations there at Pittsburgh, was at Houston Grand Opera, to which he returned as a general director's liaison for David Gockley, who, of course, you all know, served as general director of that company, and then ours. And then he actually came to San Francisco Opera as part of Gockley's transition team, and his talents have led him to become the new general director, the seventh only general director of San Francisco Opera on August 1, 2016. So, brilliance in your record is predicted. Peter Sellers, whom I first met in 1990 when he was 3 or maybe 13, and director of the Los Angeles Arts Festival. He's gained international renown for his groundbreaking and transformative interpretations, often sometimes irreverent, of artistic masterpieces and for collaborative projects with an extraordinary range of creative artists. Stage operas at the Dutch National Opera, English National Opera, Lyric Opera of Chicago, Opera Nationale de Paris, Salzburg Festival, and San Francisco Opera, among others, going, I see, in May to L.A. Philharmonic for a staging of Schumann program. He's collaborated on many works with composer John Adams. Come on in, there's plenty of room on the side. With composer John Adams, another one of our locals, including Nixon in China, Death of Klinghoffer, El Nino, Dr. Atomic, A Flowering Tree in the Gospel, According to the Other Mary. And John would be here today, but he can't because he's doing another promotional talk in the Sierras, so far away, closer to the Girls of the Golden West landmark. We know that Peter has done all these things artistically, but he's also a distinguished professor in the Department of World Arts and Cultures at UCLA and a resident curator of the Telluride Film Festival, and was a mentor for the Rolex Arts Initiative. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, no surprise, the Erasmus Prize for Contributions to European Culture, and the Gish Prize, and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was named in 2014 the awardee of the prestigious Polar Music Prize and named Artist of the Year by Musical America. So, with all that background, we're getting an inside look, as you might imagine, at the conception and production development of The Girls of the Golden West, an opera that opens the world premiere November 21st at War Memorial Opera House. Get your tickets as soon as you can. I'm going December 5th, just to let you know, okay?
It'll be good by then.
Good. As fans of the Commonwealth Club of Opera Theater and opera and all its anomalies, we all know that every San Francisco opera production is special, complex, and unique. Some are well-known to audiences, and others not at all. So Girls of the West is a new production with a Gold Rush history story about women of that time that perhaps only Gold Rush historians know a bit about. The opera is an interpretation of three interwoven stories of the Gold Rush, of these Gold Rush women whose lives intersected in Sierra Nevada 1850s, like Marysville, a mining community. The music and libretto sources include the famous Dame Shirley Letters, and that was a publication first done in 1854, I think, written by a woman who traveled with her husband to Marysville, all, of course, in search of fame, and not maybe fame, but fortune, anyway. And so they've combined her letters, which are unusual for a woman to publish at that time. They're letters to her sister, but they're so much more than that. They incorporate a sense of history and community and a penchant for commentary about all the things around, from the pigs in the kitchen to the behavior of those with whom she lived. You'll hear a little bit more about that, I'm assuming, because I'm going to ask you. This narrative, we're told, reflects some of the wildness, optimism, greed, racism, violence, as well as humor of the era. So, why develop and bring your audiences, Peter and Matthew, into here and the Opera House to experience this special, complex, and unique collaboration with a couple of other opera companies? Shall we start with the opera world context?
Absolutely. Well, it's a great privilege to be here at the Commonwealth Club. First of all, Anne, thank you for having us. This is just a wonderful institution to come and speak with. And it's a real privilege to me to be sharing a stage with Peter, who really has done more than almost anybody to reinvent and keep so virile and fertile this art form of opera by really holding up a lens and helping us understand, as contemporary people living in a contemporary world, what these works mean to us in the here and now. And I think that is so true of this new opera, Girls of the Golden West. When John Adams and Peter Sellers first came to San Francisco Opera with this idea, I will never forget the glint in their eyes. There was such a sense of rightness about this, such a sense that this was a story that needed to be told. And operas come out of many, many different pathways between the inception and the creation of the opera. But this was one of those true moments of just a real force of wanting to tell a story that most of us, even living here in Northern California, aren't fully aware of. And so for me, as we prepare to launch this opera, there's two elements that really stand out. First of all, this is our story. This is a story of life in Northern California, of the inception of modern-day Northern California. And the connection between this period back in the 1850s and where we are today as a community that is so in the midst of great growth, of change, of possibility, of an urgency, of fame and fortune to some degree for some, of great disappointment for others. So there's a wonderful sense of this is the story of Northern California. On the flip side, one of the things that I love as a Brit living in Northern California is that this is a globally iconic story as well. We're in a part of the world where almost all of our history has a global resonance of some kind or another, and the notion of the gold rush is one of those great moments. So it's thrilling for me that this will now go on to Amsterdam and then come back to the U.S. at Dallas Opera. Those are our two commissioning partners. And then it will probably almost certainly go on to other companies as well. So this is a story that will be heard around the world and will find its own resonance in each of those places. So in terms of why here, why now for the Girls of the Golden West, it's a story that both illuminates our past but also very much our present and our place in the world. Peter?
Whoa, okay, coming off of that, good morning. Thank you, Matthew. I just have to say two things. First of all, Anne, thank you for that totally delightful introduction, and nice to see you again. Hello. And just to say to wonderful citizens of San Francisco, this guy, what a relief. You've got somebody really special running this company now, and this man is a treasure. I mean, really. It's very rare in opera companies to have someone this literate, this thoughtful, this deeply from the heart and wise about how to pull it off and really how you make the hard decisions, but you make them really for what actually matters rather than convenience. And in every case, you know, the path of convenience, we've actually seen that in politics and a lot of other things. And the path of convenience is not actually a path to be on, because it's always the long way around where we become who we need to become. And that taking that little extra time, going out of our way, the detour that turns out to be the life-changing moment that you would have missed had you just taken the shortcut. And that's the case in life over and over and over again. And Matthew is committed to the more difficult and more rewarding path. And that is just spectacular in this day and age of nightmare management culture. Anyway, if I may put it that way. And just to say, obviously, our country is at the moment going through paroxysms. I mean, shock after shock after shock to the system, or what we imagined the system to be, or indeed what we imagine basic human relations to be. And it's terrifying, day by day, to see the dissolution of so many things that we hold as values, and to see a kind of flying in the face of anything we would hold as our best hope of moving forward. And to see the present jettisoned for somebody's deluded idea of the past, and the future not even to come into focus. And of course, what's powerful about the 1850s is you realize it's been worse. And we're still here. What's powerful is to look at a situation that is so appalling that you have to admire the American spirit. And you have to say, wait a minute, there's something larger that's going to outlive all this craziness. And that will persist. This opera is very, very powerful because it's, you know, when California became the United States of America, at a stroke of a pen, obviously there were a lot of people living here. They were called the Californios. They spoke Spanish. And there was a whole civilization and culture. Suddenly, in 3 years, a whole bunch of people came from everywhere else. And some of those people suddenly formed a government and suddenly made a set of laws One of my favorite is the foreign miners tax, where every not white person had to pay a tax just to be here. And that was regularly collected by broke white people who would just show up with a gun in a Chinese camp and say, I'm collecting the foreign tax. And people would come through many times a week to collect the foreign tax. And there was no redress of any kind. Obviously, the first governor of California showed up with a extermination plan for the California Indians. Those were his words, and that was the plan. And in 7 years, 90% of the population was erased. Systematically and organized, with extermination being the mission. Genocide is the word, and now Ben Madley's new book, which actually goes into such detail, you just can't believe it. But the detail is there. And it's the largest genocide in the Western Hemisphere. Happened in those 7 years in Northern California. Like beyond what happened with the Spanish and the Aztecs and the Mayans. We had the largest Native American population in all the Americas. Living in Northern California, the most diverse language groups, the most diverse cultures, all of it just wiped out. And then hanging on by fingernail by the 1890s. In any case, just to say, drama, yes, there's plenty. strangely, the origins of this opera, I mean, this is a hoary old story, but it actually turns out to be true. I've never, ever, ever wanted to work at La Scala in Italy, where opera is really a blood sport, and I don't want that blood to be mine. And I have a rule about Italy. You must never work there, no matter what. You must do everything else there, definitely. But just don't get confused. So La Scala called me and said, Mr. Sellers, we have the ideal opera for your La Scala debut, The Girl of the Golden West of Puccini. And I thought, oh, my God. But I heard my mother's voice in the back of my head saying, now, Peter, be nice. So I said, okay, let me do the research. And then I started doing the research into California in 1851 and 1852. And I said, oh, my God, the real story is so much more powerful than the cardboard popcorn cutout. The real story is incredible, and the real story happens to be what we're all going through all over again. For example, California was the first multicultural society on the planet simply because the media existed in a way it had never existed before. When gold was discovered in California, they read about it in Paris, in Cairo, in Beijing, in Melbourne, Australia. Like, it was world news. There was no world news before the 1840s. Their media didn't have that reach. Suddenly, you could read in a Paris newspaper how to go to California and how to find gold. They made all of it up. But the main story was go to California on the front of newspapers in Paris. And we're not the first gold rush opera. Of course, somebody wrote one before called Richard Wagner. It's called The Ring of the Nibelungs.
See it next June, Ian.
But when did he start writing it? 1849, right? It's when news from California reached Germany. And Wagner said, this is the topic for an opera. And he started working on The Ring of the Nibelungs. So what is incredible is what happened in California was known all over the world. And who came was everyone. They came from Brazil and Peru and Argentina. They came from Australia. They came from India. They came from Cairo. They came from Japan. They came from China. And we had Scottish people and Germans and tons of French people. And they all showed up in San Francisco. And we had black cowboys moving west. You know, because this was the first place black people could be themselves. And the organizations of black people in San Francisco in the 1850s are just astonishing. And the photographs of black people in 1851 in San Francisco, well-dressed, living their own lives, finally without fear, and this look in their eyes of we are now who we really are. This was an unbelievably amazing society for this group of years. Very exciting. And of course, everybody was going out to the mines to stake their claims. And then suddenly all of that reversed in order to make sure that certain people would never have rights. One of my favorite decisions is one of the first Supreme Court decisions of the state of California when the Chief Justice was 28 years old, a case that proved, and it's a long, long opinion. It goes for about 10 pages. He had to demonstrate that Chinese people were actually Mongoloid in race, which meant they were black, which meant they should have no rights. That's a fabulous Supreme Court decision to read. And it's crazy the extent to which people went to make sure that some part of the society would now be excluded in the future. The Californios, who were the ruling class, who were cultivated people, suddenly had their land taken away from them. All sense that they were an aristocracy was erased. And they were servants, your gardener, and the person who takes the garbage away. And had to hide. And meanwhile, culturally, because culture doesn't respond to politics or economics, it's just way more adventurous and way more tenacious. So, for example, Chinese opera was heard in San Francisco before Western opera. And that is one of our great, you know, there were two Chinese opera houses in San Francisco. And regularly, totally diverse audiences went to the Chinese opera. And it was reported on regularly in white newspapers. You know, and that's a kind of marvelous thing to just even imagine. The richness of culture here, and of course, because miners had money, even if for a day and a half, every major American theater company toured the mines, came to San Francisco, you know, Edwin Booth, you know, all of that all came here. And the very finest Shakespeare companies in America all toured the mining towns. Because the miners would throw lumps of gold at the stage for a brilliantly delivered speech from Macbeth. So you had the cream of American cultural life here in San Francisco and going up to Marysville. And that incredible richness, the richness of music, the richness, I mean, one, there's a marvelous diary by a Chilean that we've used a lot, Ramon Navarro, who, well, he was Argentinian, lived in Chile, came here, cultivated man, owned several mining states until he was forced through total, unbelievable, brutal violence against himself and his workers to flee. But his diaries from the first years are he would visit different hotels in the mining towns, just because he was interested in the music. And he is like a music critic from 1852. Like, the harp here is exquisite. This guitar playing is not very good. And he's visiting, and you get this amazing window into the musical life of the mining towns. It was so rich and alive. So all of this is what John Adams and I got really interested in. And, of course, the social, political, and economic dynamics are pretty wild of a bunch of people getting very rich and a bunch of people getting very poor very quickly and dead. And the interesting thing about the period is that literature had not simply become what it so often is today, a kind of shall we say, a moist towelette that covers it all. But in fact, people were much more forthright about what was going on. And so one of the most moving things are the famous California Miners ballads, which, you know, became known all over the world. And I got from 1861 Putt's California Songster, which has the words of about 40 mining ballads. That's what Brecht and Kurt Weill found in the 20s, and that became what their model was for Threepenny Opera and Mahogany. These American ballads, these songs where someone would tell their own hard luck story, but with zero self-pity. You know, I lost my mule, my girlfriend jilted me, my claim went broke, but hey, another round of drinks for everyone. Right? That kind of American spirit of, I'm not going to sit around and be sad. At the same time, my life is tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, disaster after disaster, and I am a personal failure.
It's like the original country western.
Well, it does have that powerful thing. And we end, one of the things that late in the piece, John set the ballad of the lousy miner, which just is devastating. But again, full disclosure, you know, and all of these ballads were composed to Pop Goes the Weasel or Oh Susanna or some tune that was already well known. John Adams has written his own tunes.
All right.
And the result is an opera of nonstop earworms. I mean, this is an opera you can hum, and in fact, you can't stop humming. Several days later, these tunes are still going in your head. It will not let you alone. The tunes are absolutely irresistible and infectious and have that energy that the mining ballads have, this kind of hard luck and press on, and don't be defeated. And that kind of energy is present. The other side, and where, as Anne said, our title comes from, aside from this guy named Puccini, is let's talk about the women. The usual way the gold rush is presented is hyper male. Mark Twain's writing, Bret Hart's writing, it's all about men. It's all men doing things to men. And what we were interested in is, wait a minute, is there another window? And as Anne said, the Dame Shirley letters are an amazing other window into what's happening. Dame Shirley was, you know, we've theorized that she could have known Emily Dickinson, but as John Adams says, actually no one knew Emily Dickinson, so okay. But again, from Matthew's old Amherst alma mater, I mean, it's that New England thing. And she inherited a lot of money. She came from an interesting family. Her nephew was the mayor of uncle was the mayor of New York. I mean, she was politically well connected, but needed, I think, a marriage in order to travel west, which is what she really wanted to do. So there was an arranged marriage with a young doctor, because that sounded good. But they had nothing really to say to each other. And he wanted to get out west, too. So they went the southern route. They went around through Panama and came up in a merchant vessel. She was in San Francisco for 2 years, and then they went north. He became one of the only doctors. And as things got really violent and the pogroms began, he was one of the only people who could treat, particularly the Asians, the Chileans, all these people who were the subject of incredible levels of violence. Meanwhile, she is a spirit who you just want to evoke right now. These 22 letters that she wrote ostensibly to her sister are, in fact, a mentor of hers said, you must write. That will help you emotionally. So she wrote to actually put her emotions somewhere. And she was directed to read the letters of Madame de Sévigné. And so they have this French elaborate commentary in them. But the main thing is, this is a woman who actually was without fear or favor. She was just interested in all human beings. And she wrote about an atrocity, the same way she would write about a butterfly. the same way she would write about what she's eating tonight, the same way she writes about how she made her toilet table out of two claret boxes. And you know, everything was equally interested. And she refused something that is very helpful to us at this particular period, to actually become a basket case because of the nightmares surrounding her. She kept her center. She held this humane center, no matter how crazy the society was around her. And what is so moving is she could write about a monster with total human insight and understanding. And she could write about very difficult topics. For example, she came across a group of Indian women weaving baskets. And she writes, the three pages she writes about those women, no other 19th century writer has written. She writes about their limbs, the beauty of their limbs, only wearing a grass skirt. And here's this Victorian woman in 45 petticoats, you know, who hasn't shown skin ever to anyone, seeing these naked, half-naked women and not being able to stop looking at them and recognizing them as this amazing, graceful species, looking at how they're weaving, seeing the rhythm in their body, and remarking on as they were weaving baskets, they kept rhythm with each other. And understanding, oh, this is a society. At the same time, of course, with her Victorian attitude, not quite being able to recognize them as human beings. And so she said, well, they reminded her of Macbethian witches. That was the only image she could have of them. She felt this kind of spiritual, supernatural presence. And then she starts talking about one 16-year-old girl who could play Cleopatra. Her eyes are so captivating. She describes the scarf she's wearing. She describes the finely knotted cloth around her neck. And she says this young girl, even though her shirt was disgustingly filthy, looked into my eyes with such poise and such clarity that we could have been the best of friends. Find that sentence anywhere else in American literature in the 19th century.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I mean, this is really an extraordinary woman. And I have to say, we've used her letters throughout, but also what started us on the track of Girls of the Golden West was what were the women doing? Two other stories I will tell you. Just one is, of course, the Chinese presence here. And we really wanted to deal with the Chinese prostitutes, what women were in this period. And, of course, this character of Ah Sing, who's based on a historical figure, who, when she first got here, was sold as a human being for $10. And she worked so hard across 10 years that the value to her owner increased and she had to be bought for $700. And she's so proud of that. And her second aria, which is "The Whore Has Changed Her Appearance," as she's bought her own first dress and says now she looks like a cute young lass. And then her final aria, which is so overwhelming, she's found a nice young man, she's made a lot of money, she says everything is fine if we can just make more money. And she says, when I make more money, I'm going to buy a farm. And it's an amazing, one of those beautiful immigrant stories of somebody coming up, and she acknowledges, of course, when I got here, I was hugely abused. But now I can make my own decisions. And you watch this beautiful evolution of this Chinese woman with her self-empowerment that is really tremendous. And then one of the other stories, of course, is Josefa, who's a well-known California story from Downeyville, the first 4th of July in California. Celebrations in Downeyville really did include the miners performing Macbeth and a patriotic fandango, independence fandango, and then a hanging, which was of this Mexican woman, Josefa, who had been aggressed by a drunk white miner and who pounded on her door at 1 a.m. July 4th, demanded she come out, started screaming that she was a whore, and she said, come in here and say that. And he walked in, and she cut him in half with a knife. Mm-hmm. Then, within hours, an angry crowd of 2,000 people formed, a mob. They demanded her death. There was a mock trial. She went back into her hut, dressed herself in her best dress, put on her jewelry, and came out to face this furious mob. And she said, if she had a chance to do it again, she would do exactly the same thing. And she had no regrets. Different accounts are that she put the noose around her own neck and said goodbye to this mob. And she's the first woman hung in California over the bridge, over the Yuba River in Downeyville. So that story is really powerful. John Adams got into it so deeply. It's the fifth scene of the second act, and I thought, okay, it's kind of a denouement, it's kind of the last moment of the opera. When John showed up with the finished score in August, that scene was 100 pages long. John had gotten so into what is the mob mentality, what is it when people give themselves permission to act on something and decide who the villain is, take justice into their own hands. And the chorus of the San Francisco Opera, the male chorus, who this is, I have to say, they have many fine hours. This is one of the finest. They are spectacular. But they got this 100 pages of music in August, and they said, what? We can't even begin to learn this. I can report, not only have they learned it, they have mastered it. But we first heard them sing it 8 Saturdays ago on the day of Charlottesville. Mm. And to hear this music on that day was like hearing Mahogany in Berlin in 1932. Mm-hmm. You just suddenly just went, oh my God. John Adams as an artist has taken us so deeply into where we are today. And 200 years from now, if people want to know what it felt like to be in America in 2017, John has taken the temperature.
There's something really chilling about that moment, because not only is the language and the music inherently frightening at that point, but it's coming out of this testosterone-built world of these mining songs that has woven through the opera all the way to that point, where we begin in Act One with those mining songs. They're kind of root-and-tootin' bar songs with this great sense of friendship and camaraderie and possibility. And it was amazing to me the first time I saw this kind of come to life on stage, just how quick the journey happens from that Act One kind of fraternal spirit into that Act Two mob mentality. And it came out of something which was already very present, and then a switch was flipped into the horrors of Act Two, and that scene, which is just built up and up and up, and then you see this mob of choristers very simply walking across the stage, but with such determination, such ferocity, and you can't help but have this cold sweat as to what's coming.
Have you just wanted to check, as an artist, Peter, and maybe Matthew's better to say, what artistically has been interpreted in the staging that's really something somewhat different, or that is, maybe it's repetitive, I don't know, but what have you been discovering in watching and in creating, either of you?
I think for me, what has been pervasive throughout this journey is a much greater sense of the authenticity of this period. And I wanted to pick up on what Peter was talking about with the research, and the depth of research that has pervaded every aspect of this is incredible. Whether it's the text and the way that Peter and John have woven text together in this narrative that is coming out of the words of this period or periods just around this time, there's a certain authenticity about that. The costumes and the research that Rita Ryack, our costume designer, has put together has changed my limited sense of what the Gold Rush looked like. I think I always saw the Gold Rush in various shades of brown, and it is so far from that. The colors, the patterns, the textures, this, as Peter's talked about, the spending one's money on the finest French silks, and the day you have the money and then going back into your dirty hovel the next day after you've now become broke again. But that the color of the Gold Rush and the vibrancy of it has been incredible. And then the musical layers that have so clearly reflected all of the different strata of races, of peoples, of ideas that are happening at this period. So for me, this has gone from being a rather stereotyped notion of the frontier mentality of the West to something very real, something very tangible. And when you see what Peter is doing with the artists in the rehearsal room, the depth to which he is going, these artists are spending up to 9 hours a day in a room with Peter, going deep into their souls, going deep into the souls of the characters. And every second of those rehearsals, Peter is intensely working with them. It's an incredible process to see unfold, because this isn't by no means just a historical reenactment of the Gold Rush. This is taking ourselves, putting ourselves into the souls of these people who were living and breathing and fighting and engaging in life in the 1850s, and just bringing that to life in a way that speaks to us now. So for me, there's a vibrancy, and I think I would say in terms of what's coming to life.
Mm. Well, it's kind of interesting that you're transforming letters into an opera. And what was the kind of, this must be a challenge, I'm sure, both musically and as a genre.
Well, what's marvelous is to find voices that we didn't know existed. You know, I mean, what were black people saying in 1852? That's a really interesting question. What were Chilean people saying in 1852? Can we actually find these voices? What were Chinese people saying in 1852? How do you hunt down those voices and include them so we really get the total mosaic of the society? That became so stimulating. So, for example, I will just say the climax of the second act is just one of the greatest and most magnificent things I know in my lifetime. Frederick Douglass, the great, mm-hmm. great liberated and abolitionist slave, gave an address in Rochester, New York in 1852 called "What is the 4th of July mean to a slave?" That address is, I think, one of the greatest moments of rhetoric in American history, and goes right next to anything Lincoln said. I mean, it is magnificent. And it's 20 pages long, so we can't quite make an aria of it. But we took excerpts from it. And I asked John Adams to please, let's replace the Copeland Lincoln portrait. I need something that has that kind of power, that kind of presence, and that people will excerpt forever from this opera and perform in symphonic concerts on the 4th of July. And wow. Really make something that gives us other words to contemplate the 4th of July with. And John has done it. John has made, it is this magnificent 12-minute aria that just opens up in scope. And of course, it's this speech was very, very, very well known. These words were very, very well known to subsequent James Baldwin and subsequent writers. These, you know, this is not time for reason. This is time for the whirlwind and the fire. This is, I mean, it's, that's after he said very, very beautifully. There's one section that John has set so beautifully. He said, I cannot believe after we as black people have been here as farmers, as harvesters, as builders of schools, as doctors, as lawyers, as, you know, chasing the whale, panning for gold. He makes this huge list of things that black people did every day. And he said, can we still have a discussion of whether or not we are human beings? It's too late for this. And this is such a powerful, powerful thing. And it rises up out of the second act like a giant, giant, like overwhelming, powerful political, social, and moral weather. A storm. And John has written an orchestral accompaniment so that the phenomenal bass baritone Devon Tynes, who is a sensation, and you will see him for many years, but this will be his debut here, he can sing absolutely with even-handed clarity, with poise, with beautifully contoured melody. And then three times in the middle of this address, the orchestra rises up in overwhelming fury. And it is about the storm that clears away the deadwood and that creates the space for the new growth. And it is it's a powerful moment. So one of the pleasures of this, as you said, is looking around and finding where are the voices from this moment. And let's put them together and see what they say together.
Someone, just following up on that, has a question about the interaction between you and John in the structuring of the libretto and the score, as it were. Did you guys?
Well, let's put it this way: we went 2 years going back and forth over the libretto, and then John spent the next 2 years writing music to what we agreed on. So it's a 5 years of our life, basically. And it goes back and forth every day, although John does like to say that, you know, it's in our relationship, we have one ecstatic night when I show up, and then for the next 2 years, he carries it until it's born. But in any case, and John has this tremendous way, particularly always in the second act of his operas, where he takes the libretto, but then internalizes it and compresses it and takes a symphonic approach. And suddenly that second act just unfurls as a giant symphonic panorama. And you just go, yeah. And it does something that goes beyond a novel or beyond a movie. It just does something only opera can do, is the sheer sweep of music carries everybody to a different place than we ever imagined was possible. And that sweep is both kind of breathtaking and exciting, but also, particularly when you're discussing painful events, healing. And I think, you know, most of the history of opera is about horrifying things. You know, Boris Godunov sets fire to Moscow three times, blinds his wife's husband. You know, not a nice guy, but very good opera topic. You know, yes. And opera is very good at going into truly unspeakable things, where actually only music can enter that space, and only music can come out of that space alive.
I just want to recognize for one second.
It made me think of Nixon in China when you talk about that.
Well, I want to go back to that point, Anne, and just reflect on the fact that, and you mentioned this in your introduction, that Peter and John have this 30-year-plus history, and how important that is in the creation of a work like this, because, and I hear this all the time in the way that each of them speak about the other, is that this implicit understanding of the rhythm of what each is trying to accomplish. And so the way that the words are being put together, the way that John is then translating that into music and then is coming back dramaturgically in the way that Peter is staging it, there's a symbiosis there that can only come out of decades of partnership together. And I mean, this is really one of the great operatic relationships, like the Strauss-Hoffmann style or Mozart de Pontes, where you need that depth of understanding. And so it's just very exciting to see that, you know, delve deeper and deeper with each of these works.
Does the opera require a larger than usual orchestra, or is it typical?
It's John's standard orchestra, so it's a full egg. Orchestra. It makes a big sound, I will say that. But John has also included, for the first time, guitar and accordion, just to give a little texture of what the mining camp sound is. Mm. And, of course, John continues thwacking away on his favorite cowbell. So, but when it's time for the full symphonic sweep, that is definitely there.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Peter Sellers and Matthew Shilbuck of the San Francisco Opera. Next question. Given the grim nature of Act Two, and it's all too true when you look at this period of history, grim is part of it, yes. How do you think it will be received by the opera public? Any clues yet? I mean, it sounds to me like something I'd immediately want to see it again, just because of the scope of what you're talking about. So bring it back in a couple of years.
Okay? Just to say, again, you go through the grim. It's like life. You go through the difficult stuff so you can emerge actually with a totally different level of strength and understanding to move forward. And it's when, you know, it's one reason why refugees are such productive citizens. Because they've seen what genocide looks like in Cambodia. And when they get to America, they open three restaurants and a microbrewery because the thirst for life is so real. You can say the same thing for the Jewish refugees that came from genocide to this country and with maximum creativity and can-do built the country just because they know what Auschwitz looked like and they know the opposite is what's necessary. Mm. So I think for me, the power of the opera is that it is so life-giving. I will just say the last word belongs to Dame Shirley. And the epilogue is one of the most moving statements I know about California. And again, the last word is a woman who has exquisitely kept not only her balance and her perspective, but her generosity and her humanity. And finally, at the end of the day, as always happens, all that evil stuff just destroys itself. It takes a lot of people, innocent people, with it. But at the end of the day, it is the original meaning of non-sustainable. Mm. You cannot sustain a Holocaust. You cannot sustain that. It doesn't lead anywhere. It actually has to destroy itself eventually. And meanwhile, the people who are committed to life, that is a sustainable project. And the only sustainable project. And so I think that's
a good way to think about
the story.
It. So there is a story, yes. Now, because you develop a story, do you have to alter some of the realities that you run into in the research to make the dramatic narrative more expressive or more impactful?
Well, the one thing I will admit to doing...
Just one?
No, because, you know, opera also, you know, the operas we love are about people who find love. And that's one thing opera does better than any art form, is just actually show you people in love. And so Act One ends very unexpectedly with three love duets in a row of people you never imagined would get together. And so the texture of Act One is something special because it gives you the rawness of the experience, Dame Shirley traveling north on a mule, And John has written spectacular music for that. And then, you know, the arrival in the Empire Hotel, and we give you the whole picture there. But then the first act ends very quietly and lyrically with three love scenes in a row. And you actually get, yes, as always, what people do during the day is one thing. What they do at night is something else. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, it's the reason we're here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, and one of those is spectacular in that it's a scene of great friendship between our protagonist, Dame Shirley, who we don't ever hear her husband on stage. We see him on stage. We never really know much about her husband, Fayette. But the real friendship with Dame Shirley and the real sense of attachment is with this freed slave, Paganini Ned. Paganini because he was a violin virtuoso. We didn't put that on De Vontaine's. that was too high of a bar. But it's a wonderful moment of simplicity that ends, as Peter said, ends Act One. And we see this unlikely relationship emerging between someone who is very much the kind of nexus point of what the Gold Rush means in Ned and what he is trying to accomplish as a freed slave, and then this commentator, Dame Shirley, and the two of them coming together is this wonderful moment of peace before what's about to transpire. So it's a beautiful end to Act One.
Good. Couple of more simple questions. Maybe one comment. You made the comment about the Native Americans. I just want to, since this is the Commonwealth Club, we do mention public policy. And there is this famous, not famous statue, we call it plop art, some of us, but in over near the Opera House, the Pioneer Monument, which has a certain attitude among the colonialists, the Californios, the pioneers, and the Native Americans. And if you get a chance before it gets taken away, because I'm pretty sure it will, go and have a look. Go and have a look at the plaque on it. Not the body attitudes are one thing, but there's a plaque. And it took meetings among 12 different interests, from the Spanish consulate to the archbishop to all kinds of people, to figure out the language, which was a task that the San Francisco Arts Commission did back in the 90s, late 90s. So go have a look at the words to describe something. It takes a lot of effort to try to do that. And so we keep going back to these things that occurred, hoping they're not going to occur again. And yet we also celebrate how diverse and divergent and rich it's made the history of California. California Historical Society, for those of you who want to do a little more research, has the Shirley letters often in their bookstore if you want to read them. And they have lots of research material. So go check it out. Someone said, Why not the girl? Why didn't you do the Girl of the Golden West? But never mind that. People will forever confuse these two. So have you thought about changing the title a little?
I have a feeling once this thing hits, it'll be clear. Just to say, again, you know, when we go through these things, it's not just history repeating itself, because there's new history. And the new history is embodied in our cast. The cast is the new generation of opera singers.
Mm.
And they are of every color. Mm. They are coming from everywhere. And they are not complexed in any way. Mm-hmm. And to watch them relate to each other and to watch them go into these roles is so exciting. And it could not happen in any previous time in history, including 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is a new generation, and this new generation comes at this stuff in a way that no previous generation could have ever come to it. So I would say the world is definitely changing, and changing in powerful and unbelievably beautiful, positive ways. And that is exemplified by the group of people, the cast. Everybody in the Gold Rush was young. So all the people on stage are this new rising generation. You don't know them yet, but you will know them after December. These people are going to change opera. And it's so refreshing and exhilarating to be in their presence and for them to get to know each other and work with each other. And you can just feel it in the room. This is a new era. And so we're telling a story from the 1840s, but not because we're in the 1840s, but actually because this cast is so brilliant, so liberated, so empowered that they can tell any story they choose to and be brilliant.
Well, and they are an ensemble cast. This is like one of the great Mozart operas. This is not an opera with one diva and a bunch of supporting roles. This is seven people who are really living this story and this journey together. And to see that in the room is incredible. And to see what that means, because within these seven characters, Peter and John are telling such a broad epic, but this is not... Go back to Mussorgsky and some of the big Russian operas. This is not an opera of thousands on stage. This is an opera that is telling the story of thousands through the eyes of the few. And the accomplishment in the identification of these cast members with the broader constituencies that they are representing is very powerful, because there's a great intimacy about that. You see the interactions that did happen or could have happened between each of these characters. And as Peter said, it's in the intensity that each of these singers, these amazing singers, bring to this that we feel like we're actually there.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up, but just two lingering questions. Who's the conductor?
Conductor is Grant Gershon, the music director of the L.A. Master Chorale,
okay,
making his debut with us, and what a spectacular debut it'll be.
Just spectacular all around.
John has written so many works for Grant. Grant works with us all the time when we begin a major opera, and he is just a musical gift.
Fabulous. Well, can we look forward to a recording someday, too?
Or a
video.
So. This work needs to be done again and again and again, because this is going to be one of the great works of the 21st century.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderfully rich discussion. So our thanks to Peter Sellers and Matthew Schilbach about San Francisco Opera's premiere production of Girls of the Golden West. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.